Aloha, you're listening to Root Cause Remedies, a show that explores environmental justice from right here in Hawaii. I'm Tina Grandinetti, and I'll be your humble host and fellow traveler on this huaka'i to learn more about the issues that affect the lands, waters, and people that sustain us. On this episode, I had the privilege of talking story with Professor Jamaica Heoli Mele Kalani Osorio. Heoli is a poet, a kia'i, and a professor of political science at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And she was one of eight kia'i who chained themselves to a cattle guard on Mauna Kea Access Road for 12 hours during the 2019 stand against the 30-meter telescope. I wanted to bring Heoli onto the show to explain how environmental justice in Hawaii has to begin with an understanding of Kanaka Maoli struggles for life, land, and sovereignty. It has to begin with an understanding of Hawaii's political status as an occupied nation and of the ways that settler colonialism shapes life and politics here. And for those of you who maybe don't know this history or don't know what I mean when I say occupation or settler colonialism, don't worry about it, because Dr. Osorio got you. That's why she's here. She's going to break it all down, and she's really going to welcome you into a new level of political consciousness. It's going to be amazing. But before we listen to the interview, I figured now would be a good time to tell you a little bit about my own positionality and where I come from and how I fit into the discussion ahead. So I was born and raised here in Hawaii. Graduated from Mililani High School, and I love Hawaii with all of my heart. But I also recognize that I am a settler here on land that was illegally claimed by the United States. My dad is Italian Irish American from New York, and my mother is an indigenous Uchinanchu woman from Okinawa. So my roots in Hawaii actually don't run very deep, just one generation. And I think a lot about how, as a settler, I'm simultaneously complicit in the suppression of Hawaiian sovereignty and, at the same time, deeply, deeply indebted to generations of Hawaiians who have fought to protect this place from exploitation and extraction. And, you know, as an Indigenous woman on my own journey to decolonize my mind and my practices, even though I'm separated from my ancestral homeland, I feel like one of the most powerful ways I can connect to my own people and my own history is actually to stand in solidarity with Kanaka and stand up for the Aina that raised me. But, you know, this is always complicated, and even though that sounds nice, sounds great, it will always be politically fraught because we inherited these super messed up injustices. We were born into them, and even though it's hard, it's our job to keep fighting to make a better world. And that's why I'm extra grateful to Heoli for taking the time to talk with us about these issues. And I gotta tell you, I was so stoked for this episode because Heoli's just one of those people who brings so much energy and passion to her work. And I had so much fun talking to her. I hope you have fun listening. Can you explain to us, give us a little brief on Hawaii's political status and what it has to do with environmental injustice in Hawaii?
Oh man, just real quick, like what's up with Hawaii? What's going on? Okay, so I don't know how brief I can make this, but maybe I'll just give a little bit of background. So Hawaii for generations was a very productive and civilized and generative society, using all different forms of governance up until the point of Kauikeaouli in the mid-1800s, when we formalized kind of a kingdom, a constitution and a kingdom, and then later a more formal kind of monarchy system. In 1893, we were illegally and violently overthrown by a group called the Committee of Safety, and assisted by U.S. Marines in this staged coup to overthrow our government. And then eventually there was this like fake annexation thing that happened. And I won't talk too much about that because that's not really my focus, but essentially they created a joint resolution to say that Hawaii would be a part of the United States. And then in 1959, Hawaii was given the opportunity to vote if it wanted to be a state. Importantly, there was no option on the ballot saying we want to go back to being an independent country. It was just, do you want to be a state or do you want to stay sucking at life as a territory? And so we became a state in 1959. But behind all of this, that's kind of what a bit of what you can learn if you read a history book about Hawaii, right? Hawaii existed, explorers came, they liked our land, military occupation, overthrow, now a state. But what's really going on in terms of the political situation in Hawaii is we're currently living in what I like to call and others like to call and think about as an occupied settler state, right? There are these two very different but interlocking forces that are influencing Hawaii's experience in the international political arena. And so this first part of it, the occupation, of course, starts in 1893 when the U.S. lands troops in Hawaii to support the overthrow, right? And those troops essentially never leave. The United States already had a foothold in Pu'uloa, the place now called Pearl Harbor, and they just basically continue this military occupation to this day. But at the same time, there's this expansive experience of colonialism in Hawaii, right? These ideologies like Manifest Destiny, the White Man's Burden, and the Doctrine of Discovery, which are all ideologies and forms of white supremacy that say European Christian nations are one, the only people who are civilized and smart enough essentially to run countries and to deal with land appropriately or to discover countries, right? This is the ideology that made Turtle Island what we know it as today as the United States of America. These ideologies inform the way the United States eventually expanded into Hawaii and the Pacific, right? In their mind, it was inevitable that they would expand into the Pacific from sea to shining sea and beyond. And so we live in this really interesting present in Hawaii, I think, because as Keuli Kamehameha III comes of age in the mid-1800s, he begins to understand that there's a real idea of how Europeans conceive of the country, right? What they conceive of as a nation. And he does a lot in an effort to protect and, quote, like, legitimize the kingdom to kind of come, what I like to think of it as like this protection of Hawaii in a certain political sense, but also to find ways to be adjacent to whiteness and this like white nationhood, right? And so in 1843, he sends off an envoy to go get international recognition for the Kingdom of Hawaii, which he succeeds in. And that's why I think the kind of ideology of the occupation of Hawaii is so important right now too, is that this idea is that even by following your kind of, your not kind of, your very racist white supremacist ideas of what a country is, we like check that box. And you came here and you circumvented your own laws around what it means to be a country and what rights are awarded to those folks with countries, or, you know. So that's kind of where we're at today, kind of sitting in the middle of these two kind of opposing and support forces that also support each other. And in my head, the way I think about this a lot is this idea of how empire, right? The United States as an empire, it has to expand in the same way that capitalism must maximize profit. Mm-hmm. That's just how these things work. And so Hawaii becomes this really strategic place, not just to make money off of plantations or later off of tourism, but as a place that can support the continued expansion and protection of this American empire because of our placement in the middle of the Pacific. Is that brief and helpful? I don't know.
That was a very helpful 101 class. Obviously, this has impacts on the land and our relationship to it. But what does this kind of background political context have to do with what's at stake?
Right. Okay. So I think about this in a few ways. One, like the first way is thinking about the kingdom in the 1800s trying to legitimize itself. One of the ways they do this is they kind of get into this game of real estate and they start, you know, thinking about aina as not just land and that which feeds you, but as something that can be owned. And so there's this really important transformation of our relationship to land on a fundamental level, right? Land is no longer just a part of my family and something that I have a reciprocal relationship to. It's something that I put money down in exchange for, right? This, it becomes real estate. And that transfer of ideology in the way that we think about land, you know, a part of it was to, Ko'i Ke Uli was certainly doing this to make sure that his people weren't just going to be pushed off the land. And I have an appreciation for that, but it also made possible for the United States and other foreign interests to come in and basically play in that game of real estate. And that's really at the root of what is allowed, what I like to think of like this environmental violence that is like taken over in Hawaii, from everything from the expansion of sugar plantations and monocropping to the way that Hawaii has been grossly overdeveloped for tourism or even, you know, for way too many people to be living here in the first place, right? We're not just talking about tourism. And so the land has both been harmed on a familial ideological level. And then, of course, there's a physical harm done to the land in order to transform Hawaii from what it was into what we see now today. When I think about this idea of environmental justice versus environmental violence, like the thing at the middle of it is this from a Hawaiian perspective, I think, is this transformation of our relationship to the land. Mm-hmm. It is the only thing that allows this violence to continue. And it's also one of the ways we can kind of discern whether or not an environmental program is actually just, right? Mm. When people are talking about, oh, we need to go, let me think of a good example. Renewable energy, right? We need to create more renewable energy resources. Let's build a whole bunch of wind turbines. This is good, right? Good with a capital G. No one could ever think this is bad. Mm-hmm. Well, let's ask ourselves the question, how does this affect the indigenous people on the land where those turbines are going to go, right? If you can ask that question and come back with an answer that says, oh, that probably harms the people there and perhaps also non-human relatives to that land, that's where we see this kind of rift that's been created through colonialism, that land is separate from people. Land is separate from the indigenous people in that place. And so that's the way that I think recently I've been trying to think about it.
Right. Okay. So when you talk about transforming the way we think about and relate to land, and we see this massive shift with the introduction of private property, we also, like, I hope we'll get to talk about your experience as a Kia'i kind of speaks to the fact that even though there are these big transformative shifts, different kinds of relationships to land still persist. The way I am most familiar with thinking about environmental justice isn't actually through that term at all, but I think the closest thing that I, the closest way I relate to it is through aloha aina. So can you define that for us and what it means to you?
Okay, so aloha aina is the word we use to describe, or phrase we use to describe love for the land. It's also a politically charged word. Kahui Aloha Aina was the name of the group of activists in the late 1800s who fought the annexation of Hawaii. They called themselves Kahui Aloha Aina. They also called themselves the Hawaiian Patriotic League. And so for the last few generations, we've also articulated a relationship between Aloha Aina and patriotism. And that's something that feminist Hawaiian scholars have pushed back on a bit, right? Because patriotism articulates a certain kind of nationhood that's rooted in patriarchy. And I, among many other people, think, I'm not so cool on this kind of association with aloha aina. I don't think that's actually what it means to love your land. Rather than define it just for myself, I'm gonna quote someone much smarter than me. Joseph Nawahihi wrote in the late 19th century, I think it's 1895, in the first issue of this newspaper called Ke Aloha Aina, he wrote an article where he defined what aloha aina means. And he says, in Hawaiian, o ke aloha aina o ia ka ume magineti i loko ka puʻuwai o ka lāhui e kauhi ana i ka noho kuʻokoʻa lana kila ana o kona one hana o pono i. I nā hoʻokokoke ia nā kui hau magineti i kahi hoʻokahi a laila he mea maopopo loa me ke kanalua ʻole o ka manaʻo lana ume like no la koapau loa ke kahi. Which basically means aloha aina is a magnetic force that draws the heart of the lāhui, the people, and draws them towards fighting for independence of the sands of their birth. But then he also says, if you take one of these magnets, one of these Aloha'aina magnets, and you take another one and you put them close enough to each other, that without doubt, they will be drawn fully together and be like pili, they'll be stuck together. And so Navahi is telling us, right, that Aloha'aina, yeah, it's this political thing. It is about independence. It is about self-determination. But it's also this thing that insists that we never refuse each other in the struggle for justice and in the struggle for our land. And so when I think about Aloha'aina, I think about Navahi. I also think about all the beautiful songs and stories that my kupuna have basically preserved for me to know to this day, and how they describe lovemaking between two people, how it's always a description of land. So Aloha'aina is also the way the land teaches us how to love each other and how to be good stewards of land, but also be good stewards of each other. That's really what Aloha'aina means to me. And I think more and more, especially in my lifetime, I'm seeing people really blossom into these beautiful understandings of Aloha'aina that reach so far beyond anything that patriarchy could inspire someone to do. That it's something that's both genealogical and familial and intimate and erotic and all of these things wrapped up into one.
That's beautiful. So one of the most important movements for Aloha'aina that we've gotten to witness in our lifetimes happened last year when Kia'i stood on Mauna Kea to block the construction of the TMT. And you were there from day one, right?
Yeah. In the most recent stand, yes. Yes.
Okay, so, oh, that's perfect. So can you, so I think it's so important for us to remember that that was the most recent stand and that this struggle had been going on for years before. So can you tell us a little bit of background about the movement and what is at stake and what drew you into it?
Yeah. Why are people so upset? What happened? okay. So because my dad's a historian, I'll jump back actually a few decades. The necessity of this particular movement kind of starts in the late 1960s when the state of Hawaii, through the Board of Land and Natural Resources, issues the 65 general lease for something like 13,000 acres of seized lands on the summit of Mauna Kea to the University of Hawaii, my employer, to build one observatory. That was everything that was written into those documents. There was going to be one observatory. But of course, this is the state of Hawaii, right? And they got slippery fingers. And so they built a number of observatories and auxiliary buildings, all without permits. And as you can imagine, that made a lot of Hawaiians and our allies really pissed off. And so what did they do? They issued permits after the fact for all these unauthorized structures. This is kind of the way the relationship between the state of Hawaii and Hawaiians and other concerned citizens has operated, God, since the beginning of the state of Hawaii. But this is like a really great microcosm to see that relationship, this back and forth, right? So the state does something very illegal and definitely unethical, and Hawaiians come out and fight with our homies, and then the state says, oh, I'm sorry, here's a permit. And this goes on for a couple decades. Eventually, the state actually admits through an audit that there was 30 years of mismanagement of the summit by both the university and the Board of Land and Natural Resources. And we should see that as like a win, right? At the same time, a few years later, the state, I think they produce an environmental impact assessment that says these observatories have done significant and adverse harm. And still, there are more telescopes being built on that mountain. And in fact, there's more documentation saying you can build an unlimited number of telescopes. That's what happens basically just before 2010, when the 30 Meter Telescope Corporation applies for a permit to build what would now be the largest and most devastating structure built within the conservation use district on the summit. So what's really important for, I think, people to understand is that there have been people fighting telescopes on this mountain since the 1960s. Mm-hmm. Since the very first telescope went up. TMT represents one too many, one too big, like this last straw. It also represents how much work our people have done in, I want to use the word radicalizing because I see it as a positive thing, but I know some people might not see that as so a great word. Okay, cool. So all the great work our people have done through a Hawaiian language movement, a cultural revival, this second renaissance to radicalize our people to see the injustice of something like a project like the 30-meter telescope. In 2014 and 2015, in particular, this movement blew up. And in my lifetime, it was the largest engagement at that time, right? It was the largest engagement I had ever seen of my people in a frontline movement against something, some kind of injustice in Hawaii. Something like, God, I don't know, like 40 people were arrested on the mountain in 2015. There was like 1,000 people who had ascended the summit to block construction vehicles from going up to the mountain. And that part of the story is really important because they ushered in both a new, an old, but also a reminder and a new way of doing frontline activism in Hawaii in 2015. They brought back like the nonviolent direct action, the civil disobedience, all of that really like exciting frontline and very important movement work really kind of blew up in 2014 and 2015 and was deeply informed by the relationships that our Kia'i at that time had built with other activists and protectors. And up until this point, that would be built later at like places like Standing Rock, to kind of learn about a lot of these practices that would help our movement be successful. And it was seeing what happened in 2014 and 2015 from my computer screen in Honolulu that really ignited my commitment to myself that I would be there the next time Mauna Kea was threatened. Up until that point, I definitely wasn't organizing at all, but I'd like loosely participated in engagements on Oahu. Like we did art stuff for them. We did rallies and marches, but I wasn't a mover or a shaker in that movement. And I wasn't completely invested in it. And when I saw people being arrested on the mountain, you know, pulled out of ceremony on the mountain by Department of Land and Natural Resources cops, like these guys, their job is to make sure that our natural resources are protected, and they're tearing Hawaiians off the land that they're trying to protect. Like that just completely enraged me. And at that point I was like, okay, this is a deeply political fight. This is about sovereignty. This is about self-determination. This is about Hawaiians having the right to offer consent to the way that our lands and our people are treated. That was kind of how I entered into that kind of commitment. And I've got to be honest, like a lot of things for me have changed since joining the movement more personally and physically in 2019. I made that commitment having never been to the mountain, right? So like, again, like it was this really political and clean cut kind of idea in my head what this was about. And then I go to the mountain in 2019 on July, I think 13th is the first night we slept there. And then everything changes. Everything changes when you stand in what we call the malu of Mauna Kea, in the shadow and the protection of Mauna Kea. Then it becomes this really personal and intimate thing we talk about with Aloha Aina, right? Then you have this mountain you're falling in love with as like a guide. You know, she makes all your decisions for you, right? She makes everything easy. And so now I don't even remember what your question was, but that's the history in my mind of like what led to 2019.
That was beautiful. I think like I spent, I think like a week on the Mauna, and like to me, it was just enough to like allow me to imagine what you're talking about. It stops being an intellectual thing.
Yes.
When you're standing, doing protocol, looking up, feeling the elements change around you and feeling your body react and respond to it. One thing I was living in Australia on the day of the arrests when the Kupuna were arrested, and you were there on that day. You were one of seven, Kia'i?
Eight.
Yes. Who spent 12 hours chained to a cattle guard. I was watching the live stream from thousands of miles away, as so many people were. But you also stayed at the Pu'uhonua for months after that. And I'm really interested in learning the long, slow transformation of spending so long up there. Mm. Like, can you share what you learned from that experience and about what the Pu'uhonua can teach us about what a Hawaii without capitalism and white supremacy and settler colonialism could look like.
The great thing about, first of all, I didn't realize you were still, didn't remember that you were still in Australia when that
happened. I was, that's why I moved back. Like, oh.
And you know what? That you're like one of probably hundreds of people who moved back in the midst of this movement who just felt so called, maybe even more than hundreds. But
yeah,
the amazing thing about being there in the beginning of the Pu'uhonua was watching all the ways that the Aina showed you that she wanted you there. You know, all these kinds of ho'ailona. In the first couple of days, every morning, like the first morning, there was one nene that flew from Pu'uhuluhulu straight towards the summit of Mauna Kea. And then the next day, there were two. And then the day after that, there were three. And the day that we were on the cattle guard, there were like five or six. The day the kupuna arrested, there were more than I'd ever seen in my life, like flocking up towards the mountain. And that's just like one example of the way that the Aina and everything around us was like, yes, it is right that you're here. And I don't think it's possible to be in that kind of situation with all these signs around you saying what you're doing is pono, like keep moving forward and not be moved and transformed. And it's funny you say that, like we were there for a long time, because when I look back at it, it feels so short. and the truth is, compared to other folks who were there for 9 months, my like couple of months there was really short. But when I look back at it, it never felt long. If everything felt like it was kind of unfolding in this almost rapid pace, and things were changing in an instant, always on the mountain. There are a lot of lessons you can learn from being, especially in the early days of the Pu'uhonua, especially when we were ready constantly for different enforcement agencies to come and remove us. In the first 2 weeks, it was a very different feeling in the Pu'uhonua in the first 2 weeks than perhaps the last few months, because it was really, everyone was on edge, right? We were having all these false alarms at 2 a.m. where we were sprinting across the street to go block the road. And I think that kind of weighed heavy on everyone there, but it also taught us a lot about what we were willing to sacrifice. Mm-hmm. For myself, after, and people ask me, like, how was it that I was able to stay up there so long? The truth is, when we came off the cattle guard, I was ready to quit my job. Mm-hmm. And there were people around me, like, telling me, like, you can't quit your job. You have to go home at some point. But once you're there, it's really hard to imagine being anywhere else. And one of the things I learned that made it so beautiful in being there is that, you know, this sounds really corny, and I can't remember who said this, it was probably like Maya Angelou or someone, but the idea is that we are the ones we've always been waiting for, right? We have all the skills we need. In a matter of days, I saw a parking lot turn into a thousand, like this operation that could feed thousands of people in a day, that could deal with our like hygienic needs, that could take care of our kupuna, that could educate our citizens, that looked out both for our physical, emotional, and mental well-being, and that was doing its best to design systems and institutions of protection from kind of people coming in to enforce against us, but also protection against the elements. All of that really showed me that this idea that we need the United States, which I never really bought into in the first place, but this idea that like we can't deoccupy, we can't have sovereignty because we need the United States to take care of us, all of that's just a load of crap.
Right.
Because given the opportunity and the space to take care of ourselves, our people show up every single time. And they go far and beyond what anything that could be offered to us by the United States or other kinds of occupying forces. And so that really taught me that I have to think bigger, and I have to have more faith in my people, but also that it only happens if we step in with both feet. It's in the same way that folks are talking about defunding and abolishing the police and prisons. You can't step in with one foot and just try to make these shitty institutions better. We need to dismantle them and in their place grow something that's actually generative, that we can actually live off of, and that we can have air, like breath and life, and we can rise from. And if you're not willing to step in with 2 feet, it's not going to work. You're setting your own glass ceiling, your own limitations. And these are hard things to like remember to do when you're back in kind of the big city, right?
Yep.
back on Oahu, surrounded, you know, now when I was living in Kailua, I was surrounded by the military there too, but like I live in Waiheoa now and it's just military everywhere.
Yep.
Like I think I can go days without, like, I don't think I could go 5 minutes beyond my house without being confronted by a military service person. So it's hard to bring those lessons from this very isolated rural place on Hawaii Island back into Honolulu and Oahu. But this is also one of the reasons that it's so much more important that we remember that we have those skills and those opportunities to transform our daily lives. And then of course COVID offers all these wild, unique challenges now.
If you think about it, it's like these moments of like crisis that create these opportunities for us to draw together like magnets. And
absolutely. Because what happens when COVID strikes? Like Hawaiians and their homies come together and they start preparing food for kids who would otherwise go hungry because they aren't in school. Mm-hmm. Right. And parents I only see this on Facebook because that's where I am, but like all my Hawaiian parent friends on Facebook are coming together to try design curriculum for their kids and share Zoom curriculum duties so that they can continue to do like their jobs aren't bullshit, but capitalism is bullshit that requires them to be working in this insane capacity when we really just need to be taking care of our families, right? Like Hawaiians and our homies show up mm-hmm. when we need to. And so what would that mean for us in a world beyond the United States of America, beyond this occupation, beyond settler colonialism, beyond even this weird concept of the nation state? Like what could we build instead if there weren't all these limitations just forced upon us? I think as dark as the present is, the future is bright.
Oh, I hope so. Please. It's nice to talk to someone hopeful. I'm hopeful too, just not at every moment.
And it's really hard to be hopeful right now, actually. I think, like, let's be honest, I think most of us are living in a pretty high functioning but deep depression in this moment. Like mm-hmm. So hold on to the hope.
Yeah. Okay, so I kind of giggled when you said Hawaiians and their homies. But it made me think about how on the Mauna, one of the most amazing things was every day during the aha, during the protocol, like you could watch and see people from all over the world, but also people from all over Hawaii, all different ethnic groups in Hawaii come to offer their solidarity at the kupuna tent to give gifts. And part of that, I mean, a lot of that was solidarity from other indigenous peoples who are engaged in their own front lines and their own struggles for land. Others were settlers who live in Hawaii, but obviously like wanted to show their support. And I think were invested in the fact that like protecting Aina in Hawaii should be all of our jobs. Mm-hmm. So can you kind of speak a little bit about the power of solidarity across difference and between movements and the power of solidarity between Hawaiians and their homies?
Yeah. Hawaiians and our homies. Because allies is so played out, right?
But I like that so much better.
Okay. So I think at the center of this for me is remembering and trying to be graceful and offering to folks that a decolonial, a deoccupied, a demilitarized Hawaii is better for everyone, right? And when I mean everyone, I don't just mean every single Hawaiian, right? I mean, basically everyone except for the 1% would be better off health-wise and in every other way that matters than we are right now. And so at the bottom of this is, without sounding too much like we're all human under our skin, because that's not where I'm going with this. But at the bottom of this is that we're all should be in this together because we can all benefit from this, that we will live a better life because of it. In Hawaii, I'm deeply moved by the folks who showed up to show solidarity to the movement in Mauna Kea, because it demonstrated to me how many more people were ready to stand hand in hand with us on such a critical issue. When oftentimes, sometimes it feels like in our own home, we're alone. And I know that's not true because we've always had allies at our back, but to see these
large groups of non-Hawaiians come and pronounce their almost like allegiance to this movement, right? Like, we stand with you. I mean, these were acts of it almost felt like, on the one hand, like, look at this diplomatic situation that's happening. Yeah, right? This is international diplomacy.
It really did.
People coming and planting their flags saying, nah, we're not with the League of Nations anymore. We're with the League of Aloha'aina. Mm. And I mean, folks who weren't up there the whole time may have missed a lot of these offerings, but one of my favorites were when the Tongans and the Samoans came. I mean, freaking beautiful. The numbers they came out with, the offerings they came with, the fact that they were our oceanic ohana, mm-hmm. coming to say, like, we see you, we love this aina too. Like, forget about the freaking rock. Like, look at what his oceanic ohana did for us. That shit was freaking beautiful. And then the number of people who came from Turtle Island who said, especially folks who stood at Standing Rock, who said, you came to us and now we're coming to you, was this beautiful display of reciprocity and aloha, and really demonstrated how much even our solidarity beyond Hawaii has been really impactful to folks, right? We had folks from Palestine come, or mm-hmm. folks representing Palestine come. We had folks coming from Standing Rock. We had folks from Black Lives Matter. And so that both showed to me that we're doing a pretty good job too at kind of showing up for others. And we can always, obviously, one of the things we've learned in the last few months is that Hawaiians can do a lot better to show up for Black lives and need to do a lot better to show up for Black lives. And yet still there's a pilina there that we can build from. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the more we can do that, the more successful ultimately we're going to be. I appreciated the number of settlers in Hawaii who came up and not just offered gifts, but also came up and worked mm-hmm. and worked really hard to keep the pu'uhonua running. That was one of the greatest shows of solidarity and commitment, is that they just, you know, they just came and put in the work, and they stood with us. And it was a good reminder that we need to continue to establish those relationships. And even though they're difficult, they're not easy.
Mm-hmm. The epic love story of the cattle guard is that you were chained with Malia Holman. You knew she had been at Standing Rock, a Kanaka who went to join the front line there. And now you guys are in love.
We're shacking up.
Aside from the epic love story, there's also this, that the way that you two met, the stories of resistance that you bring together in your relationship really speaks to this. I like this fact that, you know, we think of these indigenous movements for land and sovereignty as kind of isolated because they're being carried out by different nations in different places at different times. But it's actually like they're all learning from each other, sharing strategy, sharing tactics. Can you kind of like talk about what that means? And first of all, why? Why do so many people, so many indigenous peoples have to be in this fight? But then also, what is the power in that shared struggle? Mm.
Before I even answer that question, I just want to say that, yeah, my beautiful love story is at the center of Mauna Kea. But that's the story of Mauna Kea. The beautiful thing about Mauna Kea and the battle to protect her is that the whole thing is a love story, right? It's a love story between every single Kanaka and that mountain.
Wow.
And people felt that. Like, so many people came up to the mountain telling me, I've never been here in Hawaiian, but I never ever felt like I was Hawaiian enough, but I felt called and I had to be here. And now I know why I'm here, to like come fall in love with this mountain. And so I think that's one of the reasons that this movement is so special. But to answer your question, one, why are indigenous people continuing to have to fight for our lands? Yeah, so that goes back to colonialism, right? And extractive capitalism, and the way that, you know, historically, the value of the indigenous person was our lands and the ability of white people to exploit our lands and resources. And a lot of people think of that as this thing that happened in the past, right? All the natives are dead. because there was a smallpox blanket and they all died after Thanksgiving. And oh, so sad, the natives who are dead, right? That's like, that's what we're taught in school.
Yeah.
But no, this is like an ongoing process. Although millions of natives have died throughout the course of this violent colonial history, there are still millions of us who are still alive, very much alive, and still very much have a claim to these lands that settlers have kind of dug their heels in. And this is at the root of kind of the environmental problem across Hawaii and what is now known as the United States. It's no surprise to me then, because our experience with violence is so similar, that our experience with resistance would also be overlapping, because we're really freaking smart people, right? We're freaking brilliant. And so what I like to think of is Mauna Kea and Standing Rock. It's my understanding that Standing Rock got the language of protectors versus protesters from Kia'i.
Mm-hmm.
But Kia'i, who went to go lend their support at Standing Rock, brought back so much more information about security culture, nonviolent direct action, in rethinking the way that we can use art on the front lines and messaging, really made this stand in 2019 that much more successful. And we're continuing to learn from each other, and we're learning from Black Lives Matter and hopefully offering something to them as well.
Mm-hmm.
Malia was one of a handful of Kanaka who spent time at Standing Rock and spent time building those relationships. And I feel really grateful for the commitment in particular that she gave, because she was up there for so long, because she was a great ambassador of the importance of Aloha Aina and the commitment of Hawaiians to land and our comrades, but also because it brought so much back to us and our movement. And it prepared her for the stand that we took in 2019. I think we only move beyond these kinds of violences together, so long as the United States kind of digs its heels in this settler colonial society in Turtle Island, Hawaii will never be free. And I think that's something that we need to continue to take really, really seriously, especially in my perspective as someone who grew up in Hawaii, who in our kind of geographic, quote, isolation, we kind of live in a bubble oftentimes, and we don't consider enough about how our experience is so deeply linked to the experience of other folks around the world. I just see a lot of potential in kind of expanding upon that in the ways that we build solidarities with each other and we continue to learn from each other.
I think about all those flags on the Mauna and
yeah.
Thinking about that as diplomacy, like really taking solidarity seriously. It's more than solidarity. It is diplomacy between nations, like between peoples from all different parts of the world.
Yeah, and it's pretty crazy when you're fighting an international conglomerate like the 30-meter telescope that's funded by so many different countries, right? That a lot of our work is to seek out conversation with, you know, the fancy, you know, important people of those countries. Like, yeah, we have to go talk to India and we have to talk to Canada and we've got to talk to Caltech and like all these different schools, but we also got to talk to the people who are on the ground.
Yeah.
Right. And I want the representation from the folks who are on the ground. Like, yes, there's a strategy of pushing towards the recognized leaders of these centers. But if Aloha Aina teaches us anything, right? If our relationship to land teaches us anything, is that change comes from the ground up, right?
Yes.
That's like at the root of this idea of Aloha Aina, or even, what's that Hawaiian saying? It's ke ali'ika aina ke kawa ke kanaka. The land is the chief and the people are its servants. Doesn't just teach us that we need to serve the land. It teaches us that the leader is the one closest to the land, right? The one who has the most intimate relationship to the land, the grassroots, is what's going to drive us forward. And so, yeah, those flags, those gifts, those offers of diplomacy and solidarity, that's where it's at. That's nation building. That's world building.
I love that so much. Okay, so I have a nerdy question.
Okay.
So I am working on my dissertation and I read your dissertation. And something you wrote really, really struck me. I think you were referencing David Malo and you wrote, The living of Kanaka on a moku, an island, is what transforms it into aina. And you continue, in this way, we are encouraged to remember the reciprocal pilina between our aina and our Kanaka, that both have the mana to transform and feed each other. Mm. I'm just, since I have you stuck here, I'm just going to ask you to dig into that, because it kind of stopped me in my tracks. The living of Kanaka on a moku is what transforms it into aina. Dig in. Tell us what that means.
So, first of all, it means that David Malo is like an intellectual beast. I mean, he was one of our great political thinkers and writers. And in one of his texts, he basically gives all these definitions for different parts of land. He defines moku as land that is severed by the sea, right? So any landmass that is severed by the sea. So Hawaii Island is a moku, Oahu is a moku. And that's really what moku means. It means to cut or to be severed by something. And then he says, aina is a moku that, and I wish I had the Hawaiian in front of me. I'll just tell you what it actually means. But from what I remember, is he says, aina is a moku that people live on. Mm-hmm. And so this is something that was assigned to me in Kahikina da Silva's, I think it was Hawaiian 302 class. And when I read it, it was like two sentences. But when I read it, it was this incredibly profound idea. And to be fair, she led me on the path to think of it in this way, right? But this profound idea that aina doesn't exist unless kanaka are there. And aina is a really important word. We think of aina as land, but literally it means anything that feeds you. Mm-hmm. And so if kanaka aren't on the aina with our other like non-human relatives, then the land isn't feeding. Mm-hmm. And so we offer the opportunity through our aloha for that aina and through our work on that aina and our appreciation to that aina that we are both fed together. And it's, in my mind, it's like this decolonial, de-Lockean idea of what land is and what makes land productive. But it also calls us then to understand that we have an incredible responsibility to aina. Right? Like if you take seriously that you made aina by being there, then it requires that you behave accordingly. Mm. In the same way that like Auntie Puo often talks about, what does kapu aloha mean? She says sacred mauna, sacred conduct, right? Mm. Okay, well, what does it mean to think of this sacred relationship between yourself and aina? It means sacred aina, sacred conduct. And we need to hold ourselves to a higher level of behavior. And I think that's kind of at the one of the roots of the ways that Hawaiians have often to this day found ways to live ethically with our aina, even against all this violence, is that we know that we have this sacred relationship to land. And it really doesn't matter how many soldiers come to Hawaii, how many businessmen come to Hawaii, how many tourists come to Hawaii. The aina is aina because we're here. Mm-hmm. And the second we're gone, or the second we stop acting like Hawaiians, like kanaka, then it's all, this ain't Hawaii anymore. It's all gone. Mm-hmm. And that's like, I don't know. I think that's a really important thing for us to remember as we move forward. Like we have to really protect that relationship.
So one of the things I've been learning as I think through environmental justice is that it's really different from conservation or environmentalism. We learned a lot about that from Kyle, because it's those ideas are about a separation between people and this pristine nature. And for me, like what you just explained is there is not only isn't there a separation, but the relationship is actually what makes it special and sacred and worth fighting for.
Right. And it's, and any acts of that separation is a violence. Mm-hmm. That's why so many Hawaiians can't stand to work really in environmentalism or conservation, because none of those. And I worked in conservation for a few years when I came back from college, and it just felt like running into a wall over and over and over again, because people couldn't understand that you can't talk about land in a vacuum.
Yeah.
Right? You can't talk about clean water in a vacuum. You can't talk about any of these things in a vacuum. And that's all they wanted to do, is like put things in vacuums to try to save them. Like, you are the problem.
Put things in vacuums to try to save them.
It didn't work.
It's such a weird image. So while I was preparing for this interview, I watched a video of you performing a poem on the mauna at the Kipuka, where you were like recounting all these genealogies of resistance from like the beginning of I guess Hawaii's like twisted relationship with the United States. But I wanted to ask you, what histories of resistance do you root yourself in to keep you going in this work?
Oh man, that's a great question. You know, I love that poem. There's not a lot of poems that I've written that I actually love, but I love that poem because it was like my lifelong response to all the idiots who said to me that like activism isn't Hawaiian. I'm like, okay, watch this. Let me just tell you all the ways activism isn't Hawaiian. And the poem was actually written, I wrote the poem in 2015 after the Kia'i went up and basically committed themselves to stay on the mountain day and night. We did a 24-hour vigil for them at Manoa, and we asked them, like, what do you guys need from Oahu? Like, what can we do? And I don't know if it was Ko'okahi or Lanakila, because I didn't know them then, and I couldn't recognize their voice over the speakerphone. But they said, write songs and poems for us. Like, do what our kupuna did and, like, honor what we're doing. And so after almost a year of not writing, I went home and I wrote this poem for them. So it's actually their poem. It doesn't belong to me. It's theirs. And the poem was really fun to write because I got to remember all these stories my dad told me as a kid and kind of piece them together into this narrative of really what I'm saying by the end of the poem is that aipohaku, activism, eating rocks, you know, saying no to the false gifts of recognition is one of the most Hawaiian things we've ever done. Mm-hmm. And so some of my favorite kind of resistors are Manono and Kekuo Kalani, who fought the toppling of the Aikapu after the death of Kamehameha, who basically stood against their family and died fighting to protect their old ways. Mm-hmm. I also think a lot about Kahui Aloha'aina, who went around by boat and foot and car and horse and all kinds of things to collect 31,000 signatures of nearly every living Hawaiian at that time resisting and opposing the overthrow, or not the overthrow, the annexation of Hawaii. Up until 2019, that was the largest activation, communal activation of our people against an oppressive force in Hawaii that we had documented, that we had known of. And so I think about that moment and that movement a lot. I think about those names, not just, you know, some people say, oh, well, they failed. You know, we were annexed. Well, the truth is, we weren't actually annexed. There was no treaty of annexation. So on that level, they didn't fail. A much more important level to me as someone living in 2019, they left a record. Mm-hmm. They left a record of the fact that we did not consent to the theft of our kingdom. They left a record of what it looks like to be Hawaiian and to say no and to go out and to do the work and to organize that, like, oh, this is such a Hawaiian thing. And now we get to say that this is how Hawaiians act and fight because they left us that record. Like, to me, that seems like a really big win. So when I think now about every time that we have to go and submit testimony to another like bullshit project, like, I don't know, wind turbines or a 30-meter telescope or some other Kana'i Olowalu and federal recognition, whatever it is, right? Or the DOI coming to Hawaii in 2014. Everyone says like, oh, all these things failed, but no, all these things have records. Mm-hmm. All these things are mo'olelo that my mo'opuna are going to be able to look back and they're going to see the documentation of Skippy Ioane basically saying, Oahu's full of a bunch of freaking crooks. Get off our aina. I'm here to talk for the druggies and the incarcerated and the Hawaiians on the land. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, and they get to go back and they can watch videos of Moani Keala Akaka, you know, rest in peace, basically dig in on these guys. So when I think about the histories of resistance, I think of both the way that they pushed the needle, the way that they protected land when they held that line, but also the way that they preserved a mo'olelo for us to look back on and remember this is what it means to fight and this is why we fight. So that my kids are, let's say 2050, 2060, whatever, I don't know, my kids or grandkids, they don't have to look all the way back to 1898 to remember what it means to be Hawaiian, right? They don't have to look all the way back to the Ku'e petitions. Mm. They can look back to 2019 and see all the people standing on the Mauna, mm-hmm. right? Someone closer to them. And that's what the 70s did for the 1970s and 80s did for us with the fight against Kohol-Ave, the fight to protect Hawaiian entitlements in the 90s and the early 2000s. So yeah, it's all of it. It's every piece.
The question that I have the most fun asking is that when we talk about resistance, we're not just talking about dismantling structures mm-hmm. or opposing violence. Like you said earlier, we're talking about world building. Mm-hmm. So in your wildest dreams, what kind of world do we build in the absence of this violence?
The beautiful thing is, like, so much of this is already being built. So whenever people ask me this question, and sometimes I feel bad, it feels almost like a cop-out, but when people ask me this question, I immediately turn to my really good friends, my hoapili in Pa'oilo, Hamakua, on the island of Hawaii, Noel Peralto and Haley Ka'ili Ehu, who have been doing brilliant community engagement and organizing for the last, I don't even know, over 5-6 years now, probably. And what they're doing is they're getting Hawaiians and settlers who live in that area back on the land, learning the stories of that place. They're growing their own food. And during COVID, like, they're feeding hundreds and hundreds of people. Wow. So that's one of the things we build, right? Like, we go back to these smaller communities where we commune with each other, where we share with each other our skills. In a world where we see beyond these kinds of limitations of what is possible, and we see beyond things we take for granted as being natural, like capitalism and militarism, in a world where we move our oppressors out of the way, the things I know that are going to come up first are the things that came up first on the Mauna, mm-hmm. right? Because we moved the oppressors out of the way, and then what sprouted up? We had healthcare, right. We had education, we had doctors, but not just like doctors' healthcare. We had Lomi practitioners. We had therapists. Mm-hmm. We had food. We had a guy in the first few days before the Pu'uhonua was any big deal. We had a guy coming to clean the porta potties for free. He just started coming up. He's like, I'll be here every day.
That's so beautiful.
And that's when we had like 2 porta potties, and then we had like 3,000 people, and we were like, okay, we need some help. And so I think, like, I don't know, some Hawaiian institution helped and paid for porta potties. But, you know, we had waste management. Mm-hmm. In my wildest dreams, we create a Hawaii where every Hawaiian can come home. Mm. And it doesn't mean that a lot of people are like, oh, you want all the haole to leave? I'm like, no, I want all the developers to leave.
Yep.
I want the military to leave. I want David Ige and Kurt Caldwell to leave. But
fair.
No, like, Hawaiians get homies. Hawaiians have always had homies, right? Mm-hmm. So, and the thing is, when we move beyond capitalism, we remember that we do not live in a world of scarcity, and there is enough here for all of us. And so a lot of my ideas around what we build are, you know, I'm an academic. A lot of them are in my head. It's around changing the way we think about our relationship to each other and our relationship to land. And I really believe this gets me into trouble with my brother, right? Because he now works in the Senate, which is, anyone who knows my brother will realize that's like such a silly, like, baffling thing. But he works in the Senate. So he's really about, like, what kind of bill can I help get passed to, like, fix this?
Yep.
Like, what kind of project can I help green light to fix this? And I'm like, that's not the problem. The problem is the way people think. He's like, I can't change the way people think. Mm. And I fundamentally disagree.
Mm.
And I think if we can't change the way people think, it doesn't matter what else we want to do in this world, we're just going to keep doing the same thing. So my vision is around changing our relationship to each other and changing the way people think. And I'll leave the actual building of these institutions that replace our prisons and the police to the folks who are good at building.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll sit in the classrooms and in the fields talking to kids and teenagers about, you know, how much more there is in this world for them beyond maximizing profit and protecting from some strange idea of China and Russia coming to make us speak these weird languages, like these foreign languages, right? Because that's the idea, right?
It is.
If you weren't overthrown by the United States, you'd be speaking Chinese. I'm like, you have absolutely no evidence to prove that point. That is the most lazy argument
and yet ever. It's so common.
Oh, it's so common. That's all I get. It used to be Russian. Everyone used to say Russian, you know, because I was born in the 90s. So like post-Cold War, all the bad guys were Russian, but now it's Chinese because in the Trump era, the
the Russians are now Chinese. Yeah. So that's, those are my dreams.
I'll sign up for that world. Dreamers, yeah, please, doers, builders. We got it. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
I don't know. Is there anything you want to add?
No, I think I haven't put my foot in my mouth yet. So I think I'm good.
But that would be so much more fun.
Yeah, it would be. It would.
Okay, main takeaway from that conversation is that the ongoing suppression of Hawaiian sovereignty means that every environmental issue in Hawaii is a political issue that brings up settler colonialism and occupation, but also the unbreakable relationship between Aina and Kanaka. I think for me, that helps me to remember that whenever we're talking about oppression and exploitation, these really heavy things, we're also talking about a long and continuous and beautiful and empowering history of resistance that we all have a kuleana to contribute to. Before we go, we can't say goodbye without sharing some of Haoli's incredible poetry. Here's Haoli performing the poem Hawaii Pono'i, This Is How We Rise. Thanks for joining us. Stay rooted.
It's 1876, and David Kalakaua, not yet crowned, not yet anointed or king, pens a song at the request of Kamehameha V, Lota Papuaiva. Hawaii Pono'i, a new national anthem, a new symbol of strength, a new promise to the Kanaka Maoli of Kalakaua's generation that, like those before, they will stand and fight for their right to noho aupuni. Today, we call this resistance. Back then, we just called it Pono. Hawaii Pono'i, nana'i komo'i, kalani ali'i, ke'ali'i. So as Kalakaua writes, we sing of a generation of Maka Ainana and Mo'i who gave their fierce bodies to this legacy. We sing and we remember we are the sons and daughters of Pole, the deepest, darkest, most creative forces in this world. We sing and we remember Umiali Loa, Kiha Pi'ilani, Monono, Kekua Kalani Hawaiians, who practiced strength, resiliency, and resistance, knowing that no human power was so supreme that it could not or should not be overturned when unjust. Kalakaua writes and remembers an older Kamehameha, Kau'i Keuli thundering, Ua Mau Ke'eo Ka'aina Ikapono. Kalakaua holds this declaration in his ivi and pushes it through his melodies like we've been taught to hold it in our tongue, keep it sacred and safe from the poison fingertips of this fake state because it's 1893. An overthrown kingdom, a nation in distress, and Ellen Kehoihivo Kalani Right Prendergrass feeds her generation rocks of resistance, pens us the melodic reminder of our genealogy of protest while Kalua Iko'olau and Pi'ilani, they run through the brush at Kalalau on Kauai. Their steps are heavy but precise because they know the weight of a generation's oppression shrouding their shoulders. They realize the power from which they resist when they refuse to be wrongfully imprisoned by his sickness. So when Pi'ilani buries him, it is her tears that return his body and rifle to dust. His generation's ihe, an answer strapped across his bare chest, pointing back to Kalakaua's call to protect this legacy. Makualani e kameha, meha e na kaua e pole, meha ihe. So now it's 1895. Over 300 men led by Robert Wilcox, they take cover in the pohaku above Le'ahi. With rifles armed, with gunpowder and aloha'aina, untrained soldiers give their lives for Hawaii. But these are not the koa of the ki pu'upu'u reign of Waimea. They are only the last physical defense of a people who know in their na'au that laying down to the opposition is not an option, though they are not ihe, not malo, not ma'a. They are the koa who answer Kalakaua's call. Hawaii pono'i. Na na I na li I na pua muli ko na poki I. Now it is 1897, and America's physical power seems to be a muscle that cannot be matched. Aloha'aina of that generation take to the greatest weapon of a new time, pen and paper. Because of them, our kupuna, their names remain scratched into a new kind of stone, painting the picture of a strong, unified people, a nation whose love for Aina and Lahui could never be buried under joint resolution. Now it is 1976. After almost 6 decades of mourning, 9 young Kanaka Maoli, galvanized by the resistance to Kalama Valley evictions, they land on the island of Koho'olawe, Kohe Ma Lama Lama O Kanaloa, They have come to heal an island torn by the bombs of someone else's war, for someone else's security. On that day, the Proteko Olave reignite a practice of Aloha Aina so powerful, it defeated the U.S. military. But between March 6th and 7th of 1977, two young members of the Proteko Olave Ohana, George Helm and Kimo Mitchell, are taken. Their sacrifice confirms what we must be willing to offer back to our Lahui, that sometimes we do not return on our own two feet. Sometimes we are only a song, the sweet memory of a sweet melody. Sometimes we are only the mo'olelo for the next generation to carry. And carry we have. In 1993, 10,000 of us gathered at the Iolani Palace to hear a brilliant Manawahine Haunanike Trask proclaim, "We are not American. We are not American. We are not American. We will die as Hawaiians. We will never be American." Oh. Now it is 2019. Those of us who remain have the kuleana of their lessons laced into the backbone of our practice so that they shall never be forgotten. Hawaii pono'i e kalahui e o kauhananui e ui e. This is a genealogy of protests written from the memory of past promises on March 29th, 2015. Aloha Aina of my generation ascended our sacred Mauna Awakea. They have stayed through the night protecting our sacred people on the front lines and in the courtrooms ever since. Their sacrifice confirms resistance is a Hawaiian tradition. Aipo haku, as fundamental to our story as hula and oli, this is a true mo'olelo Hawaii of new roots sprouting from old seeds. E na po'eo Hawaii. Oni pa in this resistance, knowing that your kupuna, Robert Wilcox, George Helm, Kimo Mitchell, Haunanike Trask, Liliuokalani, Okalani, Kalu'i Ko'olau, Pi'ilani, and the hundreds and thousands who joined with them would stand with our young brothers and sisters between any aina and any desecration. We stand on their shoulders today when we insist on a better future. We honor their names. So come, sing with us. Know that when you do, you are joined by the hundreds and thousands who sang these stories before you. Know in your na'o that this is the way we rise. Hawaii pono'i nana'i.